Okay, our final speaker today is Claire Carlston, who is professor and chair of the history at the University of Illinois at Urbana. Her talk today will be Women, Work, and the Household Economy, and Appreciation of James Collins' Contributions and Thoughts on Future Directions.
Thank you. So, hi, everybody. By my watch, it's just about 9:30. So if I take my 10 minutes, you'll all have sat there appreciative but without a chance to say anything. So unlike me, if you've ever seen me give a talk, I'm going to try and do this in much less than 10 minutes so that you all have a chance to say something. And also because my work, as some of you know, is, you know, Jeanine and I had the same advisor, not at Georgetown, so there are similarities in what we've done. And so like Jeanine, my work from the very beginning was very much influenced by Jim's article on women's work and economic importance in the 17th century. And it is really quite amazing, if you go back to that 1980 article, to see the ways in which he forecast and got really most of what we've all been saying about women's work in the decades since then. And so Jim and I have been, and the other thing I wanted to say that nobody has said so far, but you can see, is not just his impact on the scholarship on women and women's work, but his role as a mentor to female scholars is really quite extraordinary, both his own students, but also other colleagues. I mean, I know he's generous to everybody, but I think he really deserves recognition for the role he's played in encouraging the work of female scholars. Okay, so... Yeah. And so Jim and I have had this conversation for the past 20 years where originally he came up to me after a paper I gave from my seamstress book and said, yeah, okay, so the family economy model of Olwen Houghton, et cetera, was wrong. Yeah, okay. So what's the new model? And I was like, I don't know, Jim, I'm a grad student. So then, and he's been asking me basically ever since then, what's the new model? We know the old model's not right. What's the new model? So, and then there's been obviously a lot of scholarship in between then. So here's my attempt in 5 minutes or less to give you the new model of no longer the family economy, but something I would call the family market family economies, because I think we have to acknowledge the multiplicity of families and also of different models. So first of all, as Jeanine just emphasized, and I don't have to go into this in detail, we now know that women participated more heavily in economic activity than we had imagined, and in a much greater variety of forms, not just traditional female trades, but also in things that were considered to be male trades, both as entrepreneurs, as widows or wives, but also as hired female laborers. There is a female labor market. Second, and I've tried to make this point in a few publications, and I'm working on a big book on apprenticeship right now with two other scholars, women actually ventured outside of the home to receive formal training for trades. The old model of women being trained by their mothers at home is a limitation of the sources. And in fact, there were multiple training programs of various levels of formality and relationship to the guild system that existed from the late 17th century onward. Third point, the flexibility, the alternance of women's work and its bridging across public and private divides and across guild and non-guild divides. So sometimes women had a continuous career over their lifetimes. More commonly, it's a divided up career, going back and forth between labor, but also between labor inside and outside of the home, and between labor in guild okay places and not guild okay places. And I think one of the things that we really understand now is that the gray market, or indeed the black market, is the norm of labor in the 18th century. It's not just the norm for women, it's the norm for men. But because of the way sources work, we have totally underestimated the role of this gray market, which guilds are often complicit in, and they participate in at the same time that they also complain about it. Also, women's role in credit networks, and my last book was all about women in credit markets, so I won't go on about that, but women are important as lenders and as creditors, and the loophole that they have to purchase on credit gives them a really important role in borrowing money and lending money to people that also the law, which says, you know, the law of coverture, which forbids women to do that, has led us to completely ignore. This is fifth point, in case you're keeping track. This is not done against the state or in defiance of the state. It is done with the support of the state. Far from discouraging women's work-related forays outside the home, the state encouraged it. And one of my favorite examples is the actions of Jean-Baptiste Colbert, you know, the architect of mercantilism, who not only sponsors the creation of a female guild, the seamstresses, in 1675, which sparks women's entry in various ways into seamstresses' guilds across France. He also works very hard to establish lace manufacturers in different parts of France where his own female relatives are directly required by him to be the sponsors. And he sets up apprenticeships, paid apprenticeships, for girls in those manufacturers, and he does everything he can to get fathers to send their girls to be trained. He also leaves 10,000 livres in his will to a religious charity school in the city of Paris, which is training hundreds of girls in trades which are controlled by male guilds, which they are not allowed to practice, specifically tapestry and embroidery. And he's totally willing to look across the spectrum of regulation and to put his own money and his own family connections to work to bring women into skilled employment. And he doesn't care about the legality, you know, the legal conditions of it. This leads two more points. The chronology that we've imagined for the 18th century, I think, is wrong. We have this idea that in the middle of the 18th century, everything changes and it opens up. I think, and this is partly Jim's work, showing that it's really at the latest, the last quarter of the 17th century, where opportunities for women is far from closing down, which is what an earlier historiography had suggested, which Jim contested in 1980, and people ignored that, I think, for a long time. Things begin to really open up as late, I mean, maybe before that, but at least by the last quarter of the 17th century. And then the final point, which this all leads to, and which Janine was already suggesting, is that women's labor was not marginal. It did not exist in the margins of things, although it exists in the margins of the sources that we use. Women's labor was central, and it was decisive for economic growth. If you want to understand economic modernization, call it that, across the 18th century, you have to understand the position of women. And just to give you an example of how far the barriers still exist, I've been doing some work with a European group on apprenticeship. The London guys have 30,000 apprenticeship contracts, and they want to make a very strong argument for the role of apprenticeship in economic modernization in the 18th century. There are no girls' apprenticeship contracts in this sample. Therefore, girls play no role in their understanding of how economic growth takes place in this period. It's just, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. But those barriers do remain, and I think not only are women crucial, women's entry into the skilled labor market, this is sort of basic Yandevries, I guess, but women's entry into the skilled labor market from the late 17th century onward is not crucial for economic growth. It actually changes the way it takes place because of the limitations on what women can do, massive entry of women into needlework and other trades related to it, massive growth of consumption in those trades, feminization of fashion, etc. So the way economic growth takes place, fundamentally shaped by women's work, not just in production, but also in consumption. And we don't have to wait until the factory girls of the early 19th century to see that in England, to see that happen. It's happening already from the late 17th century onward in France. And so I don't know, Jim, if that's a satisfactory model, but that, in my view anyway, is the new model that we have come to through the work of many of you sitting in this room and elsewhere, and in many ways really totally inspired by this path-breaking article of Jim back in 1980. So thank you very much.
All right, we do have a few moments here for questions or comments, and I want to go ahead and open that. Go ahead. If you could identify who you are and where you're from when you're in.
I'm Robert from Lincoln. Stuart, by the wonderful paper here, I would give you three very small points, then ask you, what would you define, Jim, as being a kind of a substrate to the adjective republican? It cannot be that the polities in early modern Europe that did not have a dynastic, non-elected monarch had anything in common. The Poland-Lithuanian Commonwealth, Swiss Federation, Dutch Republic cannot be put together in any one category. it cannot be that there were Republican theories, because Delacour or Milton would be perfectly happy with kings, only in England for a few years, and in Holland for a few years, they didn't want the specific dynasty, but they had nothing against kings in general. And it cannot be, number three, corporate decision structures in which a plurality of biological persons make a single legally binding decision, because that is invented by the Church of Rome, it's defined in canon law, and it's exercised primarily Church of Rome in any election of the bishop or the pope himself. So these three cannot be republican. Given that is the case, what would you say justifies the adjective republican, which only comes in the source in the 1690s as describing weird registers? Okay, what would justify the use of the adjective republican in modern historiography for the early modern period?
I don't want to go too far into this because it's not all that related to what we had for the sessions, but I would say there's a shift between the 16th and the 17th century, to go back to Felicia's paper, and that one of the concepts that's shared is this notion of citizenship, which is different in all these places. And citizens are going to share political power, but they're not going to share it in the same way. And one of the things I'm arguing in the book I'm finishing up now on republicanism in the state in France is that the French legal elite decide to share power within the state, which is, first of all, you have to have a state, but the idea that you would share it within the state rather than through, for example, representative assembly. And one of the reasons that happens in France is that the legal elite traditionally is very hostile to representative assemblies, which are dominated primarily by the landed nobility, by the small-scale landed nobility. And so there's a real conflict there in France that maybe doesn't exist elsewhere. But the concept of the citizen participating in a kind of an Aristotelian sense, I would say that is certainly shared with the Polish Schlacht or with the Vroedschap in the Netherlands, but it manifests itself, back to Michael's point, in different relations of power in different societies. Can I steal this thing for 2 seconds? All right. So I do want to say one, thanks very much for all the papers from everybody. Claire doesn't quite have it right the first time I saw her. She actually was not giving me a paper. She gave a comment to a paper. And I was so impressed by her comment that I went up to her and I said, you know, what are you exactly working on right now? And she told me a little bit. I said, you got to submit an article of French historical studies. I was then on the editorial board, which you did, which was then published. Right? So I do, since a lot of this is, a lot of this focused more this morning on mentorship, And my role as a teacher more than it will this afternoon, because Sarah is the only one of my students, and Sarah was my first student, who's talking this afternoon. I do want to recognize two people who are here. Andrzej Kaminski, who is one of my teachers at Columbia. And pretty much everything I know about teaching graduate students I learned from Andrzej and from other colleagues who are no longer with us. Now, the other person I'll recognize is the person who first gave me any kind of guidance on professional development. Why? Because all my professors at Columbia were Europeans and knew absolutely nothing about American academic life. They were worthless. So I were in that regard. So I arrive at Lafayette College. And my colleague, my dear colleague Bob Wiener is there, and my first year there, he's talking to me, he says, well, you know, on your CV you haven't given conference papers. And I said, conference papers? What is that? He said, what do you mean, what is that? He said, you've never gone to a conference? I said, no, I've never gone to a conference. So he dragoons poor Don Bailey in Winnipeg to let me on the program at the last minute at the Western Society for French History. And then he browbeats me into giving 7 papers on totally different subjects in 1 year. So I want to, all over the Western Hemisphere and partly in the Eastern Hemisphere, I want to thank Bob Wiener for doing that. All right, and I'll stop here.
Can we still have time for a couple more questions? Does anyone have questions? Comments? Anyone? Yeah, okay.
Is anyone giving a talk or a paper on Jim's tennis etiquette? You've missed a central feature of his being if you haven't done that.
We talked about Betty Eisenstein in tennis yesterday.
Good.
You were at that.
No, I can't speak to Jim's tennis etiquette, but I've played basketball with him once or twice.
Therefore, you know what an elbow is.
Yeah. I also know that I just pass him the ball and get out of the way.
That's why I need the walking stick.
Quite seriously.
Any other questions? Or no? Should we stop a little early and allow mixing mingling? Is that okay?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you very much. We have another session at 3:15. So.